Well, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The besieged Syrian rebel towns of Daraya and Maodomia near Damascus received aid convoys Wednesday. For Daraya, the first in 4 years. The International Committee of the Red Cross said it contained medicine, vaccines, baby formula, and nutritional items for children. John Kirby is a U.S. spokesman.
The United States is pleased to see that the United Nations, the ICRC, and the Syrian Red Crescent have confirmed the ground delivery of some humanitarian assistance. Ground delivery remains the most effective means to providing aid to all besieged communities. We've said that before. While this delivery today is an important step, it is far from sufficient to providing the kind of relief to the hundreds of thousands of Syrian people who are in need.
He said the U.S. will take up the matter of World Food Program delivered airdrops to some 13 besieged areas when the U.N. Security Council meets Friday. Meanwhile, U.S.-backed forces gained control of 9 villages near the Turkish border in Syria since Tuesday in an advance toward the Islamic State-controlled town of Manbij. Al-Qaeda's North African affiliate AQIM has claimed responsibility for attacks on U.N. peacekeepers in Mali that left 4 dead, including a Chinese peacekeeper. The attacks targeted a U.N. demining unit and MINUSMA base in the northern city of Gao. This identified French soldiers had a vehicle entered, rammed the security perimeter of the base, causing a detonation used by Chinese military engineers. At least 3 other Chinese personnel were wounded. At least 12 peacekeepers in Mali were killed in May alone. After Wednesday's attack, the number of UN peacekeepers killed while on active service in Mali rose to at least 65, making it the worst active deployment area for the UN in the world. This is VOA News. In Iraq, a military assault on the Islamic State's held city of Fallujah has reportedly stalled as a result of stiff resistance by IS defenders, as well as for growing concern for civilians trapped by the fighting. Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi says the city's Saqlawiya and Garba districts have been recaptured. The final stage of liberation of the city has commenced. He urged civilians to remain in their homes or make use of safe exits that the army has guaranteed. Some 50,000 civilians, including about 20,000 children, are believed to be trapped in Fallujah, suffering from what aid agencies and the UN say is food deprivation. The United States is taking new action to block North Korea's access to global financial systems. The Treasury Department Wednesday designated Pyongyang as a primary money laundering concern to continue its illicit weapons programs and other destabilizing activities. Troy Stangarone of the Korea Economic Institute in Washington explains what impact the new restrictions are designed to have.
North Korea would be prohibited from taking and utilizing the U.S. financial system. Because the United States dollar is the world's reserve currency, most transactions in the world, which are done in U.S. dollars, end up transiting through the United States at some point. And in doing so, they then go through U.S. correspondent accounts. And while there are already prohibitions on North Korean access to those accounts, this would preclude both access to those for these types of transactions and indirect access as well.
U.S. has urged other countries to take up similar steps to sever banking ties with Pyongyang. The North Tuesday conducted another failed ballistic missile launch believed to have been a medium-range rocket. Security officials in Burkina Faso say they made the first arrest connected to January's attack on a hotel and cafe that killed 30 and wounded dozens in the capital Ouagadougou. Authorities said they apprehended 6 foreigners on Tuesday who allegedly hosted and facilitated the terrorist actions. It's unclear whether any were directly linked to the attacks. Al-Qaeda's North Africa branch claimed responsibility. Militia fighters loyal to the new UN-backed unity government in Libya said Wednesday they captured a power station about 20 kilometers west of the Islamic State-held city of Sirte. It follows the taking of 2 coastal towns earlier this week. Sirte, captured by IS fighters a year ago, has become a recruitment and training center. 5 men acquitted in a 2010 attack that killed dozens watching a football game in Kampala have been charged with plotting fresh terror acts while in prison. The 3 Kenyans and 2 Ugandans allegedly created documents and materials connected with terrorist acts in prison. Twin blasts 6 years ago killed 76 watching World Cup action on television at a restaurant and rugby club in the Ugandan capital. 2 people shot dead at the University of California, Los Angeles Wednesday, prompting authorities to lock down the campus. Police described the shooting as a murder-suicide. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Today is Thursday, June 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Amnesty calls on ECOWAS leaders meeting tomorrow to sanction Gambia if it doesn't reverse its poor human rights record.
Amnesty International is calling on ECOWAS to consider the use of sanctions available to it under the protocol and the treaty, such as suspension of Gambia, if Gambia does not make significant progress towards meeting its human rights obligations.
Sabrina Matani is West Africa researcher with Amnesty International. Zambian President Edgar Lungu will file nomination papers today for his re-election. South Sudan's unity government is urged to do more to bring about genuine unity. And Burundi's government says it is committed to talks with all Burundians.
This government is committed to that process, Arusha, because if it were not committed, it would not have sent its delegates to attend the session in Arusha.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. Zimbabweans react to a newly formed loose political coalition. And Kenya's annual rhino charge raises a record $1.4 million for conservation. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Amnesty International is calling on leaders of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, who are meeting in Dakar tomorrow, Friday, to sanction member state Gambia if that country doesn't make serious progress towards human rights. Amnesty West Africa researcher Sabrina Matani tells Ricky Shryak how Gambian President Yahya Jammeh has been cracking down on dissent, particularly ahead of December's presidential elections.
Amnesty International has documented that there are serious concerns about the ability of opposition leaders, journalists and human rights defenders and even voters to express themselves freely and without fear of reprisal. And this cost of dissent in Gambia came into sharp focus recently in April and May 2016 when Gambian security forces arbitrarily arrested and beat up dozens of members of the United Democratic Party, including its leader, Useni Darbo, as well as supporters and bystanders.
What's the status of these UDP party members at the moment? Are some of them still in jail?
Yeah, so 51 people are currently on trial, and one man, Sola Sandeng, the UDP National Organizing Secretary, died in custody following torture at the National Intelligence Agency. Others were seriously injured and tortured at the NIA, and currently at least 36 people who were arrested on the 9th of May during a peaceful protest are currently detained but without charge. And Gambia's constitution does state that after 72 hours, people should be brought before a court.
This ECOWAS meeting that's going on this week, will Jammeh be there? And what do you think can happen? He is often quite verbal about that he will do whatever he wants despite whatever anybody else says. What kind of pressure can the regional leaders put on Jammeh, or can they put any pressure on him?
So Gambia has obligations under the ECOWAS Protocol on Democracy and Good Governance and indeed the ECOWAS Treaty. And Amnesty International is calling on ECOWAS to consider the use of sanctions available to it under the protocol and the treaty if Gambia does not make significant progress towards meeting its human rights obligations to consider the use of sanctions, such as suspension of Gambia. Amnesty International is also calling on ECOWAS and the AU to establish a joint commission of inquiry into the arrests and torture that happened during April and May 2016. So ECOWAS does have powers available to it, and ECOWAS is able to engage with Gambia to much stronger measures. ECOWAS really needs to show its effectiveness by not allowing Gambia to continue getting away with just ignoring its obligations.
Is there any concern that sanctions, if imposed, would actually hurt the people of Gambia and not Jammeh himself?
Well, the sanctions that Amnesty is calling for, they're not economic sanctions. We are suggesting that ECOWAS looks at the sanctions available to it, such as suspension of Gambia from decision-making powers within ECOWAS.
Did Jammeh make kind of an outlandish statement in recent days about this?
He said that Amnesty International and the UN could go to hell and that he would not investigate deaths in custody. And he said that actually deaths in custody are very common and only one person has died. So what's sort of the big deal? You know, Gambia does have obligations under its own constitution and under international regional human rights obligations. And his statement, sorry, that deaths in custody are common and that he will not investigate such deaths actually confirm many of the findings in our report.
Sabrina Matani is West Africa researcher with Amnesty International. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar, Senegal. Zambia's incumbent president, Edgar Lungu, from the ruling Patriotic Front Party, plans to file his nomination papers with the Electoral Commission today, Thursday. The electoral body has also announced that all presidential candidates will have to pay about $7,000 in nomination fees in order to participate in the elections. Priscilla Isaac, Director of Elections at the Electoral Commission of Zambia, tells reporter Peter Clotty that official nomination period for Zambia's presidential election began on May 30th and is scheduled to be concluded on June 3rd.
The presidential candidates for PF, we're expecting them at 9 o'clock, and then for UPND, we're expecting them on Friday at 3 o'clock.
What happened to MMD? Because the former president, Evans Mumba, understandably paid a 50% down payment, which the Electoral Commission says is non-refundable. What happened to them?
We just received information that they would not be fielding a presidential candidate.
Let me ask you about the controversy surrounding the awarding of the contract by this Dubai-based company to print the ballot papers. Some opposition parties are particularly not happy about it. How is the Electoral Commission addressing this concern of the opposition parties?
Well, yesterday the political parties were informed that the decision of the commission was final. We did not receive any evidence other than speculation and media reports about doubts regarding the printing firm that we had settled for. And so the commission is finally proceeding with the same printer in Dubai. And as per practice, all the participating political parties that will be fielding presidential candidates will be entitled to have one agent sponsored in full by the commission to witness the printing of ballot papers from start to finish, up to the dispatch of the ballot papers to Zambia. And of course, when the ballot papers are landed in Zambia, we'll have the party agents at the airport to receive them, to verify them before they're dispatched to the various districts and polling stations in readiness for the election.
So do you think the criticism of the fact that the Dubai-based company is too expensive and that the government, or for that matter, ECZ, would not have the money to pay for it, and that the company in neighboring South Africa that print these ballot papers that they said have not been had any problem about it, do you think those criticisms are unjustified?
Well, we believe that they are unjustified because we've explained ourselves. You know, public procurement is a very sensitive process, and we've followed the process to the letter. And ZPPA, the Zambia Public Procurement Authority, did not fault us in the award to the printing company in Dubai. The issue that was there was the appeal by the South African printer, which fell through. And in any case, the same South African printer who appealed, in their quotation, they did not even quote in full for all the requirements that we had asked for. And their specifications, the submission of their specifications, fell short of what we had asked for. And when you compare with the local government printer, which still isn't up to scratch, they quoted us 43 million kwacha, which is about $4.3 million, compared to the 3.5 that we had been quoted by the Dubai printing company.
Priscilla Isaac is Director of Elections at the Electoral Commission of Zambia. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. Burundi's government says it is committed to peace talks with all Burundians. Foreign Minister Alain Nyamitwe says if the government were not devoted to talks, it would not have sent its delegation to attend last month's East African Community-sponsored dialogue in Arusha, Tanzania. But some opposition and civil society groups say they were excluded from the Arusha meeting, accusing the government of being selective. Nyamitwe says as many as 100 Burundians attended the Arusha talks, and that those who did not attend have themselves to blame.
Well, I think the Arusha dialogue went very well. It allowed different parties to state their views on the situation in Burundi and on the way forward. We enjoyed very listening ear of the facilitator, and we hope to resume soon and discuss all the matters that might have arisen from the discussions during the last session. We really trust the facilitator, and we believe that he has the capacity and the skills that are needed in this crucial moment.
Mr. Minister, you said the Arusha talks allow both sides to make their views heard. The question is, how committed is your government to these talks? Particularly, people say you continue to be selective when it comes to talks.
No, no. First of all, I didn't say both sides, I said all parties, which means that there are more than two. Secondly, this government is committed to that process, Arusha, because if it were not committed, it would not have sent its delegates to attend the session in Arusha. And then third, I don't think it is to be responsible for this government not to participate in the talks as called upon by the facilitator, who we know has received the mandate from the East African Community Summit on the 2nd of March, a community of which Burundi is a full-fledged member.
I asked that question because during the Arusha talks, I was talking to some people in the Burundian opposition who said they were not invited. Who made the decision not to invite that segment of the opposition?
You're talking about segment of the opposition. Me, I'm talking about Burundians, those who have a say. I can tell you that you had almost 100 people in Arusha. I don't think that there are people who are more important than others. You know, people need to stop dreaming and believing that they're more important than others. Those that you're talking about, I suppose it's a group that I don't even want to mention here, but I know that a number of people who belong to that same group who attended the session in Arusha, I think they missed out and they made a big mistake. Then they should take responsibility for that. Stop blaming others, you know, accusing the government or accusing so-and-so, you know, for their own mistakes.
Where is the venue for the next possible talks? Back in Arusha or back in Bujumbura?
Our own preference is Bujumbura. Having said this, you know, we are in the hands of the facilitator. We will listen to him and advise after that.
You say your preference, but the opposition, I keep saying the opposition, will say that how can you say Bujumbura when many of your opposition key people are in exile?
You can go and ask whoever who knows the history and the politics of Burundi. They'll tell you that the people who matter in the opposition or in the government are in Bujumbura. There are people who make a lot of money, but that is not necessarily the criteria that will determine the strength of a politician. So when you say key, I'm at a loss, really, trying to find out who are those key people that you're talking about who might be outside in exile.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 2nd. Daybreak Africa time is 17 and a half minutes past the hour. The chairman of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or JMEC, says it has been more than a month since the transitional government of national unity came together, and very little has been done to improve the lives of the South Sudanese people. Festus Mohai says the former rivals, who are now partners in the government, should work as one team to find solutions to the country's problems rather than bickering over remaining obstacles. Mugumi Davis Rakarinsh has more for VOA from Juba.
JMEC chairman Festus Mohai says he has told the former rivals that they have no option but work together to improve the lives of citizens. He says in the meetings organized by JMEC, the leaders of the traditional government of national unity still behave like rivals rather than partners.
The fact that they are meeting is desirable and it's good. We note that it's some progress, but not enough. When they were speaking, they were still reporting as the faction, the three factions, the government, the IO, the former detainees. They are still speaking like that.
William Ezekiel is the undersecretary for the National Committee for Information and Public Relations. He says the former warring parties have a long way to go.
We believe that the issue of welfare states is a major stumbling block to the implementation, proper implementation of the government.
South Sudan government spokesman Michael Makwei said earlier this week that revamping the economy is not the government's priority right now. He says security across the country must be improved before tackling other issues. But Mohai says serious problems exist that must be dealt with by the traditional government now, not later.
People are starving. Crime is on the increase, both by criminals but by ordinary citizens, honest people who are prevented from their normal occupations by which they earn their living. Either plowing for themselves, plowing and planting, or looking after their livestock. People's lives have been disrupted, villages were burnt, and so on.
Ezekiel says the people of South Sudan are expecting services from the traditional government of national unity.
We need, number one, to see to it that exports are realized rather than imports. South Sudan now is depending on imports more than its exports. We don't have exports except for this oil, which is being produced.
On top of failing to address the suffering of the people, Mohai says transitional government of national unity officials are still denying aid workers access to hundreds of thousands of people in desperate need of relief.
For those in Bentiu and Malakal and Bor, the UN reports problems. When they carry foodstuffs in there, they are stopped by armed people who demand payments from them. And they tell me a total of 46 aid workers have been killed over the last 2 years. That shows that it's an unsatisfactory situation.
The parties to the agreement are yet to agree on several contentious issues, including the number of states, cantonment of SPLM-IO forces, and reconstitution of the National Legislative Assembly. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
Some Zimbabweans have welcomed a loose coalition formed this week by some opposition parties, but are warning that the alliance in its current state is not strong enough to wrestle power from the ruling ZANU-PF in 2018 when Zimbabweans go to the general polls. Thomas Chiripasi has details from Harare.
Some Zimbabweans say the coalition that was signed by five opposition parties won't be able to beat ZANU-PF. Despite this negative perception of the coalition of Democrats, Harare resident Samuel Chuma said this move was long overdue.
This is a serious issue that is facing Zimbabwe, and I think this coalition is necessary in order to have the numbers that can unseat the dictatorship in Zimbabwe. It's serious coalitions, and we need an inclusive coalition that has got the bigger parties.
However, MDCT activist Liza Mapepa said any coalition that does not include his party leader, former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai, is not a meaningful coalition.
If Morgan Tsvangirai is not there, there's no coalition. They are just playing around.
But another Harare inhabitant, Darlington Madzonga, said time was not yet ripe for opposition parties to form such a coalition.
I don't feel forming coalitions is the right time to form coalitions, because what we believe is too much groundwork should be done in terms of mobilization of membership. Each and every party leader who wants to come into a coalition should have a substantial amount of members for him to make decisions in a coalition.
Another Harare resident, James Chidakwa, said any coalition that does not include popular opposition parties was not a credible coalition.
Any coalition in this country that we can talk about, we have to talk about Morgan Tsvangirai's MDCT, and we have to talk about People First, because we know that Morgan Tsvangirai has got the people, has got the masses, has got the numbers.
MDCT says it is discussing possibilities of forming a coalition with other opposition parties internally, while Zimbabwe People First has distanced itself from moves to team up with other parties. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
Kenya's annual Rhino Charge competition brings off-road vehicles and their teams to a remote region of the country to find out who can tackle the most inhospitable terrain in the course of a day. The teams raise money to participate, and the funds go towards nature conservation efforts. VOA's Jill Craig has more from Narok in Kenya.
At first glance, it might appear these guys took a very wrong turn. But actually, they, along with 61 other cars, are competing in Kenya's 28th annual Rhino Charge competition in the difficult terrain of Kenya's Narok County.
Basically, there's nowhere you can't drive down. So downhill, not a problem. The problems we get with our little car is going uphill and when the rocks are too big.
Eric Goss and his little car have been participating in the Rhino Charge since 1998. The evening before the competition, chargers are given GPS coordinates of 13 checkpoints to strategically map across an area of roughly 100 square kilometers. Chargers must instead reach as many checkpoints as possible in 10 hours, using the shortest distance, meaning that technical skill and luck are required in surmounting rocks, rivers, mud, and bush. The event began in 1989 through the Rhino Ark Charitable Trust to raise money for the conservation of the Aberdares mountain ecosystem, later expanding to help Mount Kenya and the Mau Forest Complex. Every team must raise a minimum of about $10,000 to participate. This year, Rhino Ark raised a record-breaking amount of close to $1.4 million for conservation efforts, as well as about $44,000 for the local community. And winners do not receive prize money. While conservation is the primary reason competitors and organizers give for participating, there's another reason for the event's success.
It's a big, big thing for these guys, and there's many, many a night spent at bars around Kenya, guys talking about where they went wrong and the guy who won saying how he was so good.
For some of the spectators at the gauntlet, known as the most difficult section of the charge, they couldn't agree more. As for the Danish team, they reached 10 out of the 13 checkpoints and came in 27th place overall. And they're already looking forward to next year. Jill Craig, VOA News, Narok, Kenya.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. The Seychelles host Algeria in a Group J 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifier in Victoria today, Thursday. Turning to athletics, South African world champion Wade van Niekerk, Botswana's All-Africa Games champion Isaac Makwala go head-to-head in 400 meters at the IAAF Diamond League in the Italian capital Rome today, Thursday. Kenya's multiple Olympic and world champion Ezekiel Kemboi faces an acid test from his compatriots in 3,000-meter steeplechase. His main challengers are Conseslus Kipruto, Paul Kipsiele Koech, Jairus Birech, and Brimin Kipruto. Kenya's Elijah Manangoi and Ethiopia's Aman Water clash in men's 1,500 meters. South Africans Akani Simbine and Wenda Nell compete in men's 100 meters and women's 400-meter hurdles, respectively. South Africa's Caster Semenya, Burundi's Francine Nyonsaba, and Kenyan Eunice Sum face off in women's 800 meters, while Ethiopia's Almaz Ayana and Gelete Burka, along with Kenya's Mercy Cherono, run women's 5,000 meters. South Africans will dominate the continent's entries on the infield. Luvo Manyonga and Raswal Samai contest men's long jump. Victor Hogan and Sunet Fulyun compete in men's discus and women's javelin, respectively. In Uganda, over 3,000 runners are expected to grace the Uganda International Marathon in Masaka, some 130 kilometers southwest of the capital Kampala, on Sunday. The event is also being used to raise funds for various charity work in the Masaka community. Finally, in Olympic news, the International Olympic Committee's Executive Board supports the introduction of five more sports disciplines to the program for the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, the IOC revealed in Lausanne, Switzerland. These are karate, skateboarding, sports climbing, surfing, and baseball or softball. The IOC reckons that this will attract more youth to the Olympic movement. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a very good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Witnesses in Somalia's capital say at least 10 people were killed and more than 15 others wounded when militants attacked a major hotel on Wednesday. Somali lawmaker Mohamed Ismail Shuria told VOA that two parliamentarians were killed during the attack. He said a third lawmaker was injured. The United Nations Security Council unanimously adopted a resolution on Tuesday to renew sanctions against South Sudan's leaders for another year. They include travel bans and asset freezes on persons believed to have impeded the peace and stability of the country. That is it for this Thursday, June 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Butty in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.